Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. And today on the show, it's Sean Shebe. We're talking to him in Scotland. He's a great young player, and he has a lot of, you know, original ideas. He's a conceptual artist, I would say, and it's his approach to this entire model is interesting. So we have a great conversation. The show is sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E Classical.com. Richard over there, you tell him that I sent you, and he'll give you access to some of the best instruments that are available in the region over there. We talked a little bit about his website last time. That's Savage Classical. They've been sponsoring us for at least 8 years. SavageClassical.com. Also sponsored by RosettaPodcast.com. RosettaPodcast.com. You got to go to RosettaPodcast.com/insider. I almost forgot to say it. Without the /insider, there's no reason to go over there. Don't go to RosettaPodcast.com. It's a worthless site. You have to do the /insider or it won't work. Your computer will blow up. You'll get viruses. It's a terrible thing. Don't do it. All right. So I'll tell you what's going on. I got a new album out. But before we talk about that, we have to, you know, I have to address the death of Julian Bream, the maestro to us all. He was my teacher's teacher. He was Fred's teacher. And he was all of our teachers. Before I studied with Fred, he was my teacher. You know, when I played the Frank Martin, when I started that, I think at the end of my undergrad, he taught me how to play that. I listened to him play that over and over again. And his approach to all music has always been very filled with just life. And he took chances. And he transcended the instrument. He was an artist. And it was incredible to be introduced to his work as a young man. And I know that his interpretations and his approach to the instrument stayed with me and still play a big part in a lot of the, you know, decisions that I make, whether I know it or not. He is in the DNA of every classical guitarist. And I was really proud of you guys. I was really proud of our community. With the sentiment that you showed and the thoughtful sentiment and the honest, and I think the very sincere outpouring of, you know, grief, but also a celebration of his work and what he meant to every person individually. A lot of people wrote eloquently, and we got to see a lot of your, you know, whether it was Instagram or Facebook, we got to see a lot of your album collection that you've amassed over the years. And I thought it was a touching moment. It's always good to see us all come together around something. And, you know, he's going to live on forever in everything that we do. So rest in peace, Maestro Bream. I never got to meet you. I wish I would have. I remember there was one time early in this podcast where I had told everybody on Facebook, this is, you know, years and years, 9 years ago. So I told you all that I had interviewed Julian Bream, and, you know, I put it on Facebook, and if you clicked on it, it took you to, an episode of Benny Hill. And the reason that I did that was because it was April 1st. So there was a moment where I thought, like, seriously, I'm so stupid and getting so old that there's been little moments where I'm like, yeah, that interview with Julian Bream. I'm like, you never interviewed Julian Bream. You said you interviewed Julian Bream as a joke. And somehow in my mind that is now at capacity with bullshit, it was just, if I don't apply energy to my thoughts, I can trick myself into feeling like I interviewed Julian Bream. Does that make any sense? Well, anyway, so rest in peace, Julian Bream. You are missed, and you are loved by all of us. In what I hope is brighter news, my album came out. You know, it's been a tough road getting there, and it was real exciting to have it happen. It happened last weekend, and it was... you know, it was cool. I'm really, again, happy with a lot of the the people who have gotten back to me and they really enjoyed it. People really enjoyed the artwork, which I talked a little bit about in the last episode, but my friend Nico Trout did the artwork, and a lot of guitarists have asked me, hey, who did this? You know, can I have his contact information? And, you know, so I think that we'll see some more of my old buddy, Nico, who I've known. He's one of my best friends, one of my closest friends. You know, we lived in a building together, you know, about 15 years ago or whatever. And we've been friends ever since. So it's great. I'm supposed to hang out with him tonight in the park, right? A couple of beers. He has three. I have three. And then we go home. Maybe more than that. Hopefully not. But yeah, so that was really cool. The artwork that he did with it. I don't know if you've taken a look at it on any of my social media feeds, which I'm terrible about. I have no way to organize it. It's all mixed in there with my mom saying she loves me, happy birthday. And then there's like, I'm trying to promote an album. I mean, I know, and I have like the Brett Williams music sort of page that I'm supposed to be using, but I'm just like, nobody cares. You know? I'm not going to tell you who, but there was this incredible guitarist that we all know who's just one of the top tops, and I was helping him move stuff around in his garage once. And he was getting the stuff out of his garage, and it was just all these old concert posters and albums and CDs, and he's like, look at all this junk. He's like, nobody cares. And that was him. And, you know, same thing here. I threw out all my old CDs. Did I tell you guys that? Some guy the other day was like, hey, do you have a CD that I can have? And I was like, no. I literally, they're gone. I didn't think that anybody would want them. What is that cool? Are we going to have CDs again? Because I got to tell you, this was really nice not having to press a CD. You know, this goes both ways. I have CDs from 2006 with me and Giacomo that I never sold. So the hell if I'm into, because you know, it's a minimum $1,000 to press the CDs. Anyway, who cares? The artwork was incredible that Nico did. NicoTrout.com, he did one piece of art for every for all seven of the pieces that I wrote, and you know, you guys have been really cool about listening to it. I know that it can get irritating having, you know, these albums pressed on you, but I like to think that that this album is interesting in the sense that it's all original. It's all accessible. It's all stuff that I feel like people could play in a concert, and it would, you know, it'll go great on your programs. But I also have to, you know, really write them down. So there's that. And I don't know when I'm going to do that. I'll probably do it when I teach two students this fall. That's another development. I found I work at a school, and I found out that of my 25 students, two have signed up so far. So I'm freaking out about that, but I'm just assuming that they need to get their class schedules. I mean, the schools aren't really set in stone as far as like what time things are happening. So I'm assuming that I will hear from more of these parents and students in September. Now I have more than two students, but sort of the core of my teaching is at this one school. And I'm sure that you're going through the same thing. Scary times. Scary times. You know what I think? I think the landlords need to come down a little bit. Should be paying $50 a month. But yeah, it's bittersweet when you have an album come out. You know what I don't like about having an album come out is this Spotify crap. Spotify telling you how many people have listened. I don't need to see that. Just let me live in my bubble. I need to like plug my computer in. It's about to go dead. Maybe I should just stop doing intros that run too long. But I don't want to see that 80 people have listened to me. I want to assume that thousands of people have listened to me. What is this now? What fresh hell is this where I have to sit here and think, constantly be reminded about how people aren't listening to my music? So if you haven't listened to my music, go and listen to it. Just put it on and turn it off, you know? Tell your friends about it. It's free now, for crying out loud. What is it? There's a way to listen to it completely free. Well, if you go to my YouTube channel, you can listen to it for free. There's herenow.com, brettwilliams.herenow.com, I think is where you go, and it'll play it for you. It'll stream it for you. It's on Spotify. It's on Apple. It's on all that stuff. It's not on CDs this time. That's a weird sensation though. Getting the CD and opening it up was fun, right? Remember that? You get that box and you open it. No more of that. But I still have a lot of pride in my work. And if you are interested in playing one of the pieces, please reach out to me. I'm kind of trying to get a feel for where to get started with them as far as publishing. So the ones that people really want to play, those are the ones that I'm going to work up first. Be in contact. Let me know what's up. Donate to the show too. You know, you can't buy the music anymore, but maybe donate a little bit as if you were buying it. If you want, the show is still brettwilliamsmusic.com. It's still a little Bretty Fat Face on there. I haven't updated the website, but I'm going to. I think I'm just going to have to make it more of a teaching-based website, right? That old website's more about performance and the podcast, but I gotta start drumming up the teaching. Lord knows I'm not making money with you guys. Right? Who knows? Maybe everything will turn around with this album. But please, brettwilliamsmusic.com. Go to the right and donate. And also, brettwilliams.herenow, herenow.com to stream it. Or just look it up. It's 1T in Brett, by the way, everybody. I don't know why I have to say this. I know why I have to say this. I don't have enough listeners. I have enough listeners of this show. Everybody just go over there right now and just turn it on. Volume all the way down if you don't like me. All right, let's get on with the show. Thanks for your support. Here's Sean Shebe. So we're started. Sean, where are you calling me from right now? Or where am I calling you from, rather?
I'm not sure where you're calling me from, but I am I'm in Edinburgh. So I'm in my parents' house, and I've been here since the beginning of lockdown, and I'll probably be here for quite some time.
You went on, so you are from Edinburgh originally?
Born in Edinburgh, raised in Edinburgh. My mother's Japanese, my dad's English, but yeah.
And how you've been there since the beginning of lockdown, and you're there with them? I mean, how's that going? I haven't talked to a lot of people that have moved back in with the parents, but are you doing okay?
Yeah, wow, maybe we're reaching that point where I have to say this is something I don't want to talk about. I'm joking.
Yeah.
Look, it's fine. You know, I think, I get on with my family. And after I finished, after I dropped out of my master's, I lived at home with my parents for about 18 months or so. It's not always easy, sure. But you learn to get along with each other. And in some ways, just with the amount of space that there is here that there isn't in, for example, London, you have a different approach to work and practice and life, which I think is altogether being pretty beneficial.
Right. And so you were able to do you have a lot, do you still keep in touch with your high school friends and stuff over there? Do you have people that you hang out with? You're a pretty young guy.
My friends from high school pretty much moved away. I mean, with the exception of a couple. I was actually reflecting on this a couple of days ago with a friend, and they were like, yeah, but you know, you went to music school, you're all pretty tight. And it's funny because like a lot of the people that I went to music school with, sure, we went to like conservatory together with some of them, but by and large I think the majority of them didn't pursue music, or if they did in terms of an undergrad, they've gone on to different things since then.
Yeah, I mean that seems to be lawyers. A lot of mine became lawyers.
Right, I'm thinking of Nicola Hall, actually, right? I was listening to her playing the Decca recordings from the 90s, and she's a lawyer now, right?
That's right. So is, who's the guy in San Francisco? Michael Lorimer, I think, is a lawyer.
Right.
So, I mean, like a full-blown lawyer. So it's pretty interesting that they do that. I think it must be some performative aspect to it. But right. They do end up going into that. Let's talk about you dropping out. You said you dropped out. Now, I'm kind of unaware of all of the stuff, so this is going to be a lot of fun for the show. If you don't, the show is generally sort of irreverent in its tone towards the way that the direction we're going as musicians, as classical guitarists in particular, and as classical musicians at large. There's sort of a reaction to that, a pushback. But tell me about your early experience in Edinburgh, and how that sort of, did you start to form any of your more more, you know, volatile ideas before, like during that period, or what, how did you grow up as a guitarist?
So I was living in Edinburgh until I was about 14, and then I went to a different specialist music school, which had a boarding element in Aberdeen, which is about 2.5 hours north of Edinburgh. So in UK terms, that is a huge distance away. So I pretty much boarded there and stayed there until I was 16. And then I did my undergrad in Glasgow, finished up, I guess, when I was 20, maybe 21? No, probably 20. And then I spent 6 months in Austria, in Graz, and I was studying at the Kunstuniversität there with a professor who still teaches there called Paolo Pegoraro. And yeah, so, I mean, look, I liked Austria, and it was just a period in my life when I was put onto a different scheme. I was given a position on what is known now as the BBC New Generation Artist Scheme. And that involved essentially recording and performing in London every 2 weeks or so, which meant that living in Austria, small town Austria, quite separated from London in terms of like the transport connections that were available to me, in addition to trying to get my German to a level that I could write a 30-page thesis in a year's time, seemed impossible. So, look, Austria, no hard feelings. I mean, actually, maybe a couple. But on the whole, it wasn't because of that that I left.
It was. So it wasn't because of that. Why did you leave?
Because I couldn't juggle the commitments of the New Generation Artist Scheme with a master's.
Right. Yeah. But so Alan Neves is your sort of principal teacher, doing the undergraduate, doing 4 years with him. What was your experience like there? Was it a lot less? And also, what? But before we do that, though, what was the thesis going to be on?
Oh, look, I mean, I was so vestigial in what I'd sort of set out to do in my master's that I wasn't even at the stage when I decided to write about a specific thing. Like, that's right. How basically non-committal I was towards it. You know, I was there for the teacher, as we often are, right?
And always, yeah. Yeah, it's I find it is sort of irritating to have to do all, like, in the case of going to grad school, for me, I didn't like the fact that I had to retake certain courses. You know what I mean? I had to continue doing sightseeing, air training for some reason. I don't know. And then I did it and I was fine. Or, you know, you have to do advanced counterpoint, or you have to study Beethoven again. And it seems like they need to kind of come up with more for us to do or something more interesting or something more guitaristic.
Interesting, yeah. Well, look, I mean, I have to say that a lot of the things that then I was either, you know, not ready or, you know, not mature enough to be interested in, I've kind of taken a further interest in now, you know, yeah. So but it's one of those funny things. I mean, I was quite young when I started in undergrad, but at the same time, there were people saying to me, oh, you know, you're too young, you're not going to appreciate what this is giving you, et cetera, et cetera. But I also think that, like, you know, I didn't have altogether a great experience in undergrad, and I don't think that, like, anything would have prepared me to be ready for undergrad except doing an undergrad.
Right. Yeah, you had to do it. And I mean, but that, by the time you're done with it, you dropped out of the master's program. And was that also so that you could just get started as an artist and start, you know, producing and playing? I mean, you have a very extensive concert career, correct?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not anymore with COVID. Thanks. But
yeah.
Look, I sort of think that It's quite easy to be institutionalized, isn't it? And I think, yeah, like, I didn't really want to, and absolutely no disrespect to those who have chosen to do so, but I didn't really want to, you know, go straight into teaching at a conservatory or whatever, you know? I didn't really want to hang on to the stability of an institution for essentially emotional reasons, using the excuse of a PhD. Like, when I get around to doing a PhD, I'll have something I want to say with that, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to, yeah, I mean, you know, in your words, I wanted to, like, start career building. make some records, perform in the halls that I always wanted to perform in.
Yeah, and you've done that so far, right?
Yeah.
With the exception of COVID.
Yeah, thanks for nothing.
Pandemic. I know. It really had to set it back. How have you been spending your time with this, though? Have you been recording? Have you been learning new works? Have you been commissioning?
I spent a lot of time drinking, and then, you know, it's not very sustainable. It's not a very sustainable practice, least of all when you're with your parents. And then I sort of realized I wanted to play the sweet things that I'd not really played so much of before. I find myself generally preoccupied with larger, disturbing, postmodern, oppressive structures. And so coming to something like Mon Po in the context of what we're going through, COVID, felt like a very authentic move. And you know, it happens to be quite record friendly. So now that I've signed a record contract with a new company called Pentatone, and that will be our first release. We intend to record in August, and it should be out early next year as well.
So you find yourself moving generally with the sort of push that you've gotten from COVID into a more gentle, almost reflective sort of tone.
Yeah, I'd say that.
With your last album, which was Bach, right? You had a Bach album, and then the album before that was what? What was it called? Soft Loud, correct? Am I right?
Well, you're nearly correct.
I'm so almost friends, correct.
they call it Soft Hard.
Soft Hard. But I don't, is that what it's called? It's not called Soft Hard.
No, come on. It's just my friends.
They say that. Yeah, yeah. They're like, hey, how about that album Soft Hard? Well, what is it?
It's a combination of two different sides. So look, when in 2016, a friend who was previously a manager and a producer for the BBC Three radio station.
Soft Loud is what it's called, yeah.
Soft Loud is what it's called, yeah. But yes. He came to me and he was like, look, it's just after the election of Trump and it's just after the vote for Brexit, like, what do you want to do? And I was like, you know, I'm really angry. I want to do something furious. So on one hand, there are things like the Scottish Lute Manuscripts, which are very humble, beautiful, gentle tunes that sort of symbolize this lost vernacular, the sort of more statesman-like, quiet-voiced strength that I feel is missing. But, you know, maybe it's not a bad thing it's missing. And then the other half is music for electric guitars. So a lot of looped stuff. But when it comes to something like Lad by Julia Woolf, it's really furious. It's pretty angry, elegiac writing. And it sort of sums up something else. You know, it's like, what is the best approach when you're faced with something like Trump, which is like this kind of Moloch that seemingly is, you know, it's like Teflon. Nothing sticks to him, does it? And somehow playing this musical scream felt like a very, you know, responsible reaction to something as ineffable as Trump's.
Well, he's got us all in that corner, and you know that's what Trump does. Is he's got us in this corner where he's not listening to anybody. And so you do what you do when that happens, whether you're in a relationship or anything, you just scream, you know, you just get angry. And I do understand that with Julia Woolf, you know, when I listened to that, that sort of was reminiscent. Is that the one that sort of sounds like bagpipes a little bit? It's got a drone, and then it's also got some stuff that occurs in the subsequent movements of it that sort of...
So she's based in Brooklyn. She's one of the people who founded Bang on a Can with David Lang. And Michael Gordon, and this piece was written, I think, after the death of John F. Ladd, who was a violinist and a very good violinist and a friend of hers, and I think a friend of the general collective as well. And so it was written for Nine Bagpipes originally, and the premiere, I believe, took place with a piper on each of the floors of part of the World Trade Center. So you can imagine that kind of cyclical drone-like violence reverberating around those financial chasms.
As far as you know, your relationship with her, have you met her? Have you
No, I've never
met her. Did you arrange that piece for guitar?
Yeah. And she said she's very happy with it, and she's pretty compelled by it and that kind of thing.
Good.
So, I mean, there's a degree of support there. I mean, you know, I hope she has listened to it. Hopefully she's not just saying that. I think it's a really effective piece. I'm when I was younger and, you know, more dogmatic, I would never have thought that at this stage I'd be playing essentially minimalism, you know? But it can be a really potent thing, especially when programmed in an effective way.
Now, as far as the programming, especially of that, which won you the Gramophone Award, that particular album, Self Loud, is as far as sort of the structure of that, how do you make sense of it? In the sense that you start out with some, if I'm not mistaken, some Renaissance pieces or some divertimento and stuff like that. You move through some Scottish traditional music, and it's all very, very quiet. It's very contemplative, and you're playing obviously in some sort of a hall, and there's a lot of dynamic use. There's a lot of subtleties, and then you move into more or less a wall of sound at some point with the Reich and with the Wolf. And what was your idea there to sort of have music that is so grounded in the tradition of classical guitar, and then something that really departs from it in a really dramatic way, all in the same album? I don't know if that's been done to that degree before.
Yeah, I hope not. I hope I'm the first.
You're the first ever.
but I mean seriously, I think. You know, there are a lot of relationships that I wanted to explore in the album, and we begin with this piece, which is, yeah, you're right, it's a divertimento, by a composer from Fife, so it's just across the Firth of Forth to the north of Edinburgh. It's very close to where I grew up. He was a composer who then moved to England after getting some success, started publishing his own music, and he was very much, you know, savvy to the aesthetic preferences of the time. So when he realized that Italian music was popular, or at least music by Italian composers, he changed his name to David Riccio, trying to sound more Italian.
What year was this? What approximate time?
I'm going to check the absolute
dates. Yeah, absolute dates, but yeah.
I don't want to...
No, that's okay. We can actually we can do a little editing, too.
Okay, so James Oswald was born in 1710 and died in 1769. So he was also the chamber composer for George III, the king in England at the time.
Wow, okay. That has a special relationship with us, you know.
Right, the Mad King.
Well, that's what we call him, even though from what I understand, he was a good king in the beginning. He was not a good king, but he was certainly not mad.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't know. I'm pretty French about these things, you know.
Are you really? Are you a continental? You said you're French about these things, or you feel...
I'm pretty French about these things, yeah.
So how do you mean French? Tell me what you mean by that.
Off with their heads.
Oh, okay, so no kings allowed.
Oh, you know, it's pretty anachronistic, isn't it? I mean, look, the divine right of... It's kind of a bit obscene, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And, you guys had a good shot at trying to evade something close to the divine right of kings, and somehow you've ended up with your own regal families of... presidencies inherited and ordained.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do, and they continue to you know, bask in wealth. Continue. So he went from Edinburgh. He went down to England. He changed his name to an Italian name because the Italian music was becoming more and more popular.
And he wrote these pieces for what was called the English guitar, which was a curious wire-strung cittern-like instrument tuned entirely in C major, hence the limited tonality of these pieces. So essentially what I was doing there was trying to begin with the most gentle thing that I could find and move through these Scottish lute manuscripts, which admittedly are from slightly earlier in a period. They're from before the Union of Crowns between Scotland and England. So this is about, you know, early 1600s with examples from examples of tunes that you've also found in Portugal, in Spain, France, Italy, Germany. I think in the mammoth Balcarres manuscript, which is in inverted commas like the most professional of the manuscript, there are about 50 tunes from France, but only about 7 or 8 from England. So it's very much a record of the military and political alliances of the time. And from there, I moved to the contemporary, but I wanted to sort of keep this Scottish flavor. So I arranged this tune that James Macmillan, a contemporary Scottish composer, had written for solo clarinet, for the guitar with the help of a good friend of mine, George Duffy. And so the Macmillan sort of marks this shift from the definitely ancient lute music into something more contemporary. And I do that by including a piece that he wrote for the Theorbo. So we've got a Scottish composer writing contemporary music, kind of counterpoint, for an ancient instrument.
Yeah.
And then moving into Steve Reich through that means that you have an American composer dealing in a very different way with counterpoint, but with a very modern instrument. And so going into the piece Lad by Julia Wolf, for a Scottish composer, for a Scottish instrument, sorry, by an American composer, and then played bizarrely in this kind of inversion on an American instrument as well. There are these different lines that I feel I can draw between all the pieces that give me a feeling of this being a cogent argument for something. And that feeling that I have then is what I think gives me assurance that this is good programming.
Right, it's good programming, and also, but as far as the conceptual element of it, was that something that you went into learning the rep, or did you already sort of have the repertoire sort of set it up separately, and then once you had it all ready to go, you went and then you found similarities that would justify it, or was it conceptual from the beginning? In other words, did you know what you were going to play before you set out to play it?
I knew what I was going to play, yeah, and then it was a matter of making it work. So there were things like, you know, like when I came across Lad and I was like, this fits what I had in mind. I was like, I don't know if this is going to work on electric guitar. Then I went out and bought an electric guitar, right? Like, for me, with this project, the electric guitar is definitely a solution.
What kind of electric guitar did you get?
I got a Fender Stratocaster. It's made in Mexico.
There you go, a Mexican Strat. That's it. Nice and easy. And what kind of amplifier did you get? I'm sure people are kind of...
Yeah, sure. It was a Hot Rod 3.
A Hot Rod 3. There you go.
Yeah.
And that
was... All-American, baby.
Was that your first... All-American, baby. Was that your first electric guitar?
No.
Or did you...
But it was probably my first, like, properly playable electric guitar.
Yeah. So as far as, you know, the concept, going into this conceptually, your aim, you've said, with the album was to... And of course, I'd love to talk about other things, but the album is just obviously very striking and very sort of telling of your aesthetic. And so, you know, you've already said that, or you suggested that the goal of the album was sort of a response to Trump and Brexit at that time.
Mm.
Was that the idea from the get-go, or was that just
you've got the right emotion. Yeah.
Right. So emotionally, you're upset. You feel like some terrible things are happening in the world. We're going way too far to the right, and you're responding as a young person too, you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think, like, you know, what's the alternative? I mean, when you put people in impossible positions, you can be naive not to expect something like looting and rioting to happen.
Exactly.
But I think that, like, it is incredibly violent music, and sometimes it is incredibly loud. I mean, talking about live performances, and I think that something about that violence and that noise is genuinely therapeutic. I mean, it's probably better for me to be playing this music, and having, like, you know, a couple walkouts, than going out and throwing.
You've had people walk out
and that kind of thing. Oh yeah, loads. I mean, because look, I mean, classical music is pretty conservative. I mean, if I'm going in front of this audience and I'm like, you know, this is really about how I disagree with you at a really fundamental level about your politics.
Right.
People do leave. Yeah, sure. In Wigmore Hall in March, I wasn't playing that program, but I was playing the electric guitar, and it was a very disturbing, violent piece. I think there were 30 to 40 walkouts, 10 demands for a refund, and
was this because you were
somebody's hearing aid?
Was it? Okay, so they were walking out because it was too loud, right? And also that maybe there were some political elements, because obviously, so when you go on stage, you actually express yourself politically.
Sometimes, yeah.
In Wigmore Hall?
I mean, sure, yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's very brave, I think.
Yeah, but...
I mean, we hope that everybody who listens to us is progressive. But you know, it's once no, you're
I
actually.
I kind of prefer if they're not progressive, you know, like because then it's like, I mean, you know, the progressives are already on your side. It's good to attempt to speak some kind of truth to whatever power you are able to get yourself in front of. And you know, like one of the things about the riot, is that
about the riot over here.
The right wing in general, right?
Oh, you meant the riot. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, it's mm-hmm. my disgusting accent. I know.
You have a wonderful accent. It's perfectly clear.
Thanks. I was fishing for that one. is that, you know, they say about, isn't it one of those rightisms that they say of the left? Well, you know, the left, when they find somebody to disagree with, they think that they're evil. But the right, when they disagree with somebody, they just think they're wrong. And I think, you know, I would much prefer to be in my position as on the left playing to people who are on the right than be on the right trying to speak to people on the left and put out my opinions that way.
Yeah, that's true. Like, yeah, it's kind of a nightmare.
Because they're like, the right, when you do that kind of thing, they're like, oh, it's just a naive young artist. Like, isn't that quaint talking about, like, Marxism, you know?
Right.
But it would not be the same way the other way around, probably, especially, you know, musically.
Well, I mean, you know, when you are, you're right now, you're in a situation. Well, I also want to kind of speak a little bit more about this. I don't think that people understand, you know, everybody thinks that they want to speak out and that they want to do things. They want to do the marching and stuff like that. But when you're actually doing it, when you're on stage or when I've done it on the show, last week I had to address the Black Lives Matter movement over here. And I addressed it in a way that was very clear. And for the first time, the show, I had said, you know, that, you know, this show is denouncing the hateful rhetoric of our president. And that was something that took a while for me to figure out how to do tastefully and how to do without sounding like I was grandstanding. I hope that people out there understand how hard it is for a performer to actually speak up. It does take a little bit of bravery and work. So, you know, I commend you on doing that, especially on such a big stage. But the people who are walking out, that's interesting that you're playing it so loudly. Because a lot of the electronic music that's presented in a concert hall is done relatively quietly at about the same volume of an acoustic instrument. You know, when you hear the piece, is it the John Adams that's done with the recorder and guitar, you know, or whatever that is? Is that right? Am I right about that one? What's the piece for tape and guitar?
Do you mean on the CD that?
Not you.
Or you mean in general?
No, you're in general.
I don't know this John Adams piece, but I'm curious.
I might be wrong. I might, and people will have to
correct me.
But there's a, so, you know, those sort of situations, it seems like people sort of are trying to temper the sound of it. What do you do? Do you play it over incredibly and over a PA system? Like, what do you,
well,
what are you
look,
up to?
I mean, in that situation, I was playing a piece called Ingwe, which is by George Lentz, who's a composer from Luxembourg, and in the score to the piece, it says, wait, I'm just trying to find the score, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
I want to get the exact wording.
It's great that we can do this with computers in front of us now. Yeah, we can actually look stuff up very quickly.
No, I found the score. I'm just trying to find the... Okay, so Yngwie has got written as a performance direction, triple forte from the beginning, and always with great pain and with a blazing sound. And in addition to that, he says, you should have the treble EQ turned up to maximum to give something really crisp. The volume in fortissimo should be deafeningly loud. As far as possible, the guitarist should stand up for all the piece. It should be played with expressive body language, especially with sustained passion and pain and intensity in the fortissimo passages. Never just play the notes. Never play deadpan. It must be played as though your life depended on it.
Right. So he's giving you blocking cues, essentially. He's telling you exactly what to do.
Yeah.
And so, you do it. So, yeah. And so, I mean, how do you feel about people walking out? I mean, is it something like you're proud of, or is it something that you kind of, I mean, what do you think? Is that something that you aim for?
I think what I aim for is to create a program that I think is coherent and says something that I feel, and I feel disturbed by a lot of what I see, and I think that like I also don't understand what I see, so putting out something that is, on one hand, also not very comprehensible in terms of this gigantic postmodern piece, Yngwie, which is like 50 minutes long. It's incredibly loud.
It's 50 not in or 15.
50.
Jeez, man. That's a lot.
Very long. But and so that feels like it feels like the only response actually to something as crazy as what we see to like, look, the Nazis are back, the world's burning, and you know, I'll also happen to never own a house. It's like people are like, yeah, you're kind of mad to play this music, and I'm like, I would be mad not to. Like, is that like, do I really want to be responding with Giuliani Rossiniana's? I mean,
yeah,
I think some people do, and that's really fair. Some people do it really well. I'm just not one of them.
Yeah.
At this point in time, I just want to explore it in different ways. And look, if some people leave, I understand. Life's hard, and it means that art is hard. But I think at least I can be like, yeah, I was honest.
Yeah, right on, man. That is right. Yeah. The world is burning, and we'll never own a house. It's the truth. And you're mad. And so what are you doing as far as that's concerned? You know, at your age, you're sort of at a pivotal moment. You have this performing career. You have a career as an artist. Are you doing anything educationally? Are you going into the teaching realm at all? Or are you avoiding that for now?
Like, am I teaching at conservatories, basically?
Yeah. Or are you aiming at?
Well, no, look, basically not. I do master classes at the UK conservatories largely from time to time, probably two or three times a year. So part of what I'm doing under lockdown is contributing also to the Royal College of Music as a sort of like kind of guest seminar leader next month. Alan sometimes has me back into the Royal Conservatory of Scotland to take like a performance class or something. Mm-hmm. A couple of classes at the Royal Welsh at Royal Birmingham. But, you know, in terms of a stable job, I just feel like there are other things I want to do right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like also, you know, that there are people who take on a teaching job and they're like, I really want to have this performing career on alongside of it. And I guess I feel like maybe I wouldn't want to do that. I'd want to really like create like my studio, you know, and I'd really want to like just focus on the students and take on with the appropriate amount of gravity, the responsibility that you have there, when you're really, you know, shaping somebody over that time. I'd want to do it properly, and I can't do that right now.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's something that I don't think enough teaching artists think about when they take these jobs, especially some of these really high positions are, you know, absorbed by these people who are completely unavailable. You know, they're on tour all year long. So you know, we've talked about, you know, your reaction to things that happened in 2016. What about now? 4 years later, you know, you've gone through, since then you've done the Bach album. What compelled you to do that? And then I want to talk about sort of what you feel would be the appropriate reaction musically to what's going on right now, which is obviously one of the most volatile moments in modern history. So let's talk about what compelled you to do a Bach album. Is being someone who's so you know, experimental, not experimental but conceptual. What compelled you to do something so traditional and something that so many people have tackled before?
Well, I mean, Bach is unconventional. Bach is the original maverick. Bach's suites are the original expression of, like, cosmopolitan Europe. It's multicultural. I mean, I guess I'd sort of question your question and say, like, is Bach not the most iconoclastic? I guess maybe the pressing question is, like, why now, right? I'm kind of young. Why not do this in 10 years or 20 or 50, right? We only have so many of these so-called lute suites. And they're kind of really precious, right? Because we have such few works that we can sort of claim as our own.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's because we treat them in that really precious way that we over revere them. And I guess I was really inspired by a colleague of mine when he had this conversation with a journalist. And he said, you know, recording the cello suites is a huge weight of responsibility. And I realized that the longer I went on not having recorded them, but having very obviously performed them, and he won the Bach competition in Leipzig as well, right? So everybody knew he was like a Bachian.
Right.
And they were sort of expecting this recording. And he just said, like, I realized I have to do it now, put out my youthful definition now, shirk that weight and come back to it in 20 or 30 years and do it again in a different way, something completely different to say.
Yeah.
I don't think, like, I think a lot of us are like, oh, you're so naive, so young, you should, why are you recording the Bach suites when you haven't recorded, you know, XYZ piece by, like, Soren Giuliani, right? I just don't think musical development works like that. I really think I have a deeper understanding of these pieces than I would have had I not recorded them and waited 10 years to record them, you know? I think there are also issues in the suites that I chose were the more texturally thick ones, the ones that are more firmly keyboard works than arguably works for lute, right? So I guess what I'm saying is that actually they are the more difficult suites.
Yeah.
And there is part of me that wonders, you know, what's going to be happening in 10 years? Like, what happens if I got a car accident or, like, you know, or my hands are just not up to it anymore? Because I think these suites present issues that have rarely, if ever, been tackled. I'm thinking of things like, for instance, the fugue from the suite BWV 997, which most guitarists, I feel, take at, you know, a pretty largo pace, but I feel is undeniably more Gigue-like in character.
Mm-hmm.
And the speed that therefore requires rests on a technical edifice that I really wonder if, you know, I wonder that many people will ever have that, let alone am I able to do this at 28. So I felt in some ways more prepared to do it now,
right,
than I would later. Yeah, I feel like that basically sums up why I chose to do this.
Well, it certainly is true. I mean, in like you're saying, you know, the sort of the approach to Bach by many of the masters has been, you know, Yo-Yo Ma, Glenn Gould. You know, I was talking to Jason Vio last week, and it's he's coming out with his second album, the last one being 10 or 15 years ago. You know, this is sort of the way that Bach is approached. Is there is a young recording, there's a 1950 whatever it is, six recording of the Goldberg Variations. There's a 1982 recording of the Goldberg Variations. So that makes a lot of sense. And the other thing is that there's nothing that replaces the youthful excitement and energy of understanding and falling in love with Bach for the first time. In other words, you know, my relationship with Bach as a 43-year-old is very different than my relationship with Bach was as a 23-year-old. When I was 23, it was very clear to me that that he was the best composer that ever lived. And as time has gone on, things have become more subjective. And, you know, I've moved away from the sort of pure excitement that came with hearing and playing Bach for the first time. So I think what you're saying has a lot of merit, and I don't think that young people should shy away from Bach at all. I was more or less just sort of, and you explained it very well. You know, I was asking you in the sense of, it seems very, it was a violent shift to go from such a conceptual and modern approach to both modern music and Renaissance Baroque music, and then going straight up into a full Bach album. But you explained it well in the sense also that you were talking about the keyboard-esque elements of the lute suites that you had performed, and that was a decision that you had made. I guess you had made because you felt like they had been that you had a fresh approach that you could put, particularly on the fugue.
Right, like, you know, like when I'm putting down an album, like, do I think inherently as a basic tenet right. of album making that what I'm bringing to the music is something truly unique? Like, yeah, I do. It sounds arrogant, I know, but I think, you know, that's, I don't want to just make albums because it's a great device with which to build a career.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
because I genuinely believe there is aesthetic merit to, and not just merit, but beyond merit, right? Like mm-hmm. Undeniable individuality to the musical decisions that I'm making.
And you said that you found a cosmopolitan element in Bach that you find very attractive. And that's something that you were also talking about with the Divertimento at the beginning of Soft Loud. This is something that you're attracted to, is this element of, you know, unification and everybody kind of coming together in the juxtaposition of different cultures and elements. Right. Is that something that you're, and I mean, look at the, you know, the recordings that you've made. Is that something that you generally are attracted to? Is someone or something that goes, you know, across county lines, we would say?
Yeah, well, I guess what you're sort of saying is, like, you know, this idea that music heals us by bringing us together, right, and uplifting us together and proving some kind of, you know, shared humanity, right? Is that
well, I'm not really looking for that so much, but I guess that would be sort of, you know, the view, a positive view taken on cosmopolitan intellectualism and stuff like that. Yeah, sure. Is that something that you look for when you're programming? Is that a viewpoint that you're looking to sort of?
I think it could be construed that way, but it's not really a view I take yeah. so much. I think it's actually sort of, it can be quite a vapid message, you know, like the power of music to heal right. and music speaks louder than words and, you know, music transcends politics and that kind of thing, you know. I think music has been used for, like, terrible political reasons in the past yeah. as well. And, like, I think often that message conceals a simple commercially exploitative system.
Right. Yeah, and how so you feel like music can sometimes reveal the system in which we're living in, which is largely exploitative. But you also, I mean, sticking to that point, you know, one of the first things you said during the interview was you had a visceral reaction against Brexit. And is that just, I mean, obviously the economic implications of that are pretty clear, but I mean, do you feel like, you know, you as an artist, you know, do you feel that just the idea of being taken out of the European Union, does that have sort of an emotional effect on you?
I think what's the shocking thing about it is that so many people voted for it. I just didn't really, right. I really didn't think that would happen. I mean, look, obviously when you put a two option decision in front of people, you're going to end up with, you know, referenda are the A-bombs of democracy, right? And you know, I was naive. Look, I think the European Union is deeply flawed, sure. I sort of also feel like probably it's altogether a better thing than the other things it has. I think also, you know, the decision that people made in leaving was often based on this idea that we'd be reclaiming some kind of sovereignty, which in the context of the authoritarian anachronism of Westminster is patently not true. We're wresting back authority, but giving it to who? People who are less democratically elected than they are in Europe. And Westminster has far more control over our policies than the European Union does, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't want these decisions to be in the hands of of Tory MPs who are from families who have literally sent six MPs to Parliament from their family at any over the course of their family's existence, you know, who, like, for instance, literally owned slaves, who were literally still being paid off by the British government for the slaves that they were forced to free.
Wow.
Until 2011, you know? I mean, it's really as insidious as it sounds.
Yeah. And so there's a lot to be, you know, there's a lot to be upset about right now, you know, before this year. But, you know, what's your reaction? Do you have sort of a plan, or not a plan, but are you feeling an impetus to create a musical reaction to what's going on in the United States right now?
So, a colleague, so I went to a music festival in 2013 called Marlborough Music Festival.
Sure.
And it's a really great, like, summer camp based in Vermont. And you're sort of just crammed into these log cabins for 7 weeks and given a bunch of booze. And then, you know, you have these amazing experiences of making music together. And one of the first situations that I was put in was preparing the Songs from the Chinese by Benjamin Britten with a really fantastic Lebanese-American tenor called Karim Suleiman, who won a Grammy last year, actually. So he's just gone on the up and the up. And he FaceTimed me the other day and he was like, look, I have this mad idea that that I think you might be, you know, really into. So, like, Kareem's Lebanese American, as I said, and I'm, like, British Asian, and so we both experienced a sort of disembodiment through spending, like, so much of our life performing music by white people in white spaces.
Yeah.
And in a way, you know, this first musical experience that I mentioned, this Songs from the Chinese by Britten, amplified and exemplified that. It's not only a white composer, it's not only a white space, it's also a white man's take on an Eastern aesthetic. So what Kareem and I aim to do with this project, that is very much in a vestigial stage, is reclaim for ourselves these Western-lensed appropriations of the exotic. So what we will do is essentially begin with examples of how our cultures are appropriated by the West, slowly moving to more balanced examples of non-Western composers working within the Western canonical system, and then to other things like the Grecian invocation of, you know, Greece, not only as what the West sentimentally thinks of it as being, which is the birthplace of civilization, but also as the gateway to the East. We're considering a couple of different commissions, but I think, you know, in terms of thinking about the inherent colonialism of Western classical music, and thinking about how to, you know, claim some of those things and make them our own, and, you know, essentially make this music, but also feel a little more at peace with it. I think on a personal level, never mind the societal, I mean, this is not going to have a great societal effect, you know, it's going to be an album project, it's going to be a little concert tour. But in terms of what that will do for me personally, in terms of what I think it will probably do for Kareem, personally, I think, you know, that will be something quite nourishing as well.
I think that sounds, no, and the thing is that I think that if it's everybody's responsibility right now to live their life reflecting what their viewpoints are, and I think that that's what you're doing. It doesn't, whether or not, if everybody does what you're doing, then socially we're all going to, you know, end up at the same point. So you're, it's not unsubstantial from a society standpoint, you know, that kind of a thing. And, you know, I commend you on it. You know, so you're looking for a way to actively at least assess that viewpoint, that cultural appropriation in terms of you know, what's going on with our art form, which it's widespread. Everybody, Rondo a la Turk, everything, you know, all these you know, examples of Western music, you know, taking from or at least sort of reflecting their own viewpoints onto what is going on in the East.
Yeah.
And is that something you grew up with? You know, because you grew up in a multi, not, yeah, I don't know what to call it, a multicultural environment. You had a Japanese mother and an English father. Is that right?
Yeah.
You know, as far as like your relationship with Japan, do you ever, you know, is she from Japan originally?
Yeah, yeah. So she was born in a pretty small fishing town on the south coast of the main island. And she came to Scotland in her 20s and pretty much settled here. Yeah, I mean, look, growing up as an Asian guy in Edinburgh in the 90s was not like super easy. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's very far from, you know, a difficult experience, but it was like at that time Scotland was one of the most ethnically homogenous places in Europe, by which I mean obviously like very white. So I was one of like two or three Asian kids in primary school,
yeah.
Out of like, you know, 800 kids at that school. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff to unpack there that I only realized later on with like, you know, historically speaking about the US, for instance, like the historic and I mean, to some extent, ongoing emasculation of Asian men, and hyper feminization and fetishization of Asian women in Western society. Like, why is that? What does that mean to how I present myself now? Like, why, you know, should I be wearing these traditionally, you know, masculine clothes if I don't feel super comfortable in them, like suits, you know? Is that like the real way for me to present myself on stage?
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently.
So there's a lot of things that are going into your art, you know. It sounds very, very cool, and I really appreciate it. So moving on, is, you know, we're kind of coming to the end of the program, unfortunately, but go ahead and tell me if there's anything that you'd like to speak about at all, you know, whether it's something that's coming up or whether it's you know, something that you've wanted to express to the guitar community or, you know, anything.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's so many things.
That's the dumbest question I've ever asked.
No,
is there anything like, you want to express to the guitar community, Sean?
I sort of feel like I'm not really part of the guitar community in the way that I once was. You know, like I don't really visit guitar festivals or that kind of thing. You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I do, but there, part of me misses that kind of time of my life and that sense of a very close-knit community. I think possibly being outside of it to the extent that I am, which is, you know, it's a limited extent, but it is true that in contrast to some of my colleagues, I spend a lot more time outside of it. I do think it's really enriched my life and you know, I think a lot of, you know, music that guitarists play and are have their interest captured by through guitar festivals is often like not very interesting to the wider musical public. And I guess I really want everybody to challenge those roles. Like, why do we continue to go to classical guitar competitions when we know that the prize is like the first prize is literally just as much money as you get from playing at any major concert hall, right?
Right.
And then what do you get in return of that off the back of the concerts, off the back of the winning the competition in terms of the concerts, right? You just get engagements at guitar festivals, and it's not like, I don't know, you know, you know, my main issue with that is that it's not creatively fulfilling, and as a structure through which to nurture the next generation of musicians, I don't think it's a particularly inspiring one. But I think that also just from a more like cutthroat aspect, it's not particularly financially viable either, right? I mean,
yeah.
Like, what are you going to do? Like, do the same thing as like a bunch of really good guitarists have done in the past and just win like 40 first prizes and then like, cross your fingers you get a professorship. I mean, I like to think there's more that we can aim for, more that we can say and more that we can react to. And I've never found the... Well, it's not that I've never found. It's just that I do find myself a bit frustrated sometimes with guitar festivals and the kind of behavior they encourage.
I agree. And yeah. The other thing about it that needs to be addressed is the fact that, you know, it really is for rich kids. You can't be a poor kid and win competitions. You can't be a poor kid and get, you know, a $20,000 guitar and fly all over the world winning competitions. You got to be a rich kid. Yeah, and that's not cool either.
yeah. My God, you're so right. Yeah. It's something that... Look, I mean, when I was growing up in Scotland, I went to, like, essentially these boarding schools, right, that were specialist music schools, but they were all state-funded, right? None of us paid any fees.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't really aware of, like, the extent to which the class divided existed, especially, you know, in terms of, like, the way it manifests in America.
Right.
Until a little bit later. And, yeah, it really is shocking. I mean, you know, if all the people playing music are coming from the same socioeconomic background, what kind of spectrum of life experience are we offering through our music? Not a very interesting one. The middle class experience is not a one that that communicates, like, you know, the fullest range of human experience.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you speak to something we talk about a lot on this show, which is the limited opportunities that are presented to guitarists. It's sort of the foundation of what I try to work against is the idea that the only thing you can do out there is be a soloist who is playing Bach, Giuliani, and Soar. And if you can't do that, you know, goodbye. You know. So, you know, that's why I really wanted to have you on the show. I was really drawn to you. So, you know, thanks so much for coming on and talking.
Pleasure for having me. Yeah.
Absolutely, Sean. Thanks so much. That does it for my time with Sean. I hope you enjoyed it. Please join me next time. I'm going to have Laura Mazon on the show. Laura Mazon. Make sure that you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/insider and donate if you feel so inclined. And definitely 110% if you have any love in your heart for me at all, listen to me on Spotify or iTunes. Okay? Just do it. It's not a big deal. It's not that much.